Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Capital punishment is debated in Kentucky.
Corrections officials are expected to commit the most premeditated murder possible. I mean, I had a policy book that thick. We rehearsed it. How premeditated could it be?
Coal camp communities are working to cope with dated water systems created by coal companies.
And a lot of the coal's been gone, and it being a non-renewable resource. Therefore, we're faced with an exodus of a lot of our people, with a crumbling of the infrastructure that was here. It's almost non-existent today.
A farmer's market is providing summer meals to children.
The future of that community has to be great. And when our children see what we're doing, that has to be an encouragement to them, and it works out for the best for them in the future.
These stories and some old-time music coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Mirroring a national trend, the debate over capital punishment continues to make headlines in Kentucky. Earlier this month, the state legislature held the first public hearing testimony on the death penalty since it was reinstated in 1976. As Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter reports, the arguments for and against a bipartisan legislative effort to abolish capital punishment boils down to, in part, a moral quandary over vengeance versus forgiveness.
Alan Ault admits to being a murderer.
I have murdered 5 people as an agent of the state.
But Ault isn't behind bars, nor was he tried for his crimes. He's currently dean of criminal justice studies at Eastern Kentucky University. But as Ault told an interim joint committee on the judiciary earlier this month, he considers his actions as a director of corrections akin to premeditated murder.
Corrections officials are expected to commit the most premeditated murder possible. I mean, I had a policy book that thick. We rehearsed it. How premeditated could it be?
He says many of his former colleagues have committed suicide or retreated into drugs to cope with their actions. Ault's perspective is one that doesn't often present itself in the debate to abolish the death penalty in Kentucky. Usually, that debate centers on a battle between vengeance and forgiveness. Proponents of the death penalty argue that it's a deterrent that works to prevent heinous crimes. Others argue that it's a moral and financial burden that the state cannot afford. A 2010 federal injunction has barred Kentucky's correctional institutions from conducting executions due to concerns over how lethal injections are carried out. Those concerns have also halted executions in Oklahoma, Ohio, and, most recently, Arizona, where death row inmates reportedly suffered due to botched lethal injection procedures. Kentucky doesn't possess the drug cocktail necessary to carry out executions and is barred by the court from obtaining them. Currently, 33 people are in limbo as they sit on Kentucky's death row. One of the 33 is a woman. 4 are African American. Another concern is the cost of carrying out the punishment itself, at about $80,000 per execution, according to the Kentucky Justice and Public Safety Cabinet. And factoring in the costs of appeals, Ault and other experts say that the cost of keeping an inmate on death row can reach 3 times as much as an inmate who's sentenced to life without parole. In addition to the costs associated with housing, feeding, and providing health care for the prisoners, some of whom have languished for nearly 30 years, it costs the state $140,000 a year to pay for their security detail, according to the Justice Cabinet. But not everyone is moved by moral pleas or hawkish dollars and cents arguments against capital punishment.
See, you're talking to me about the death penalty is like taking a drink of water out of a fire hydrant.
That's Ray Larson, Fayette County's Commonwealth's attorney, arguably one of the most outspoken proponents of capital punishment in the state.
It's an appropriate punishment for somebody who chooses to take another life. I just am a believer that that's an appropriate penalty. I don't have to defend it. I think it's an appropriate penalty.
Larson has personally prosecuted cases resulting in death sentences. He doesn't believe that the state is capable of prosecuting an innocent person and says the death penalty prevents inmates sentenced to life without parole from murdering prison guards. Larson refutes a 2011 study by the American Bar Association, which states that 64% of death sentences in Kentucky are fraught with errors because, he says, that report was funded by a grant from the European Union and is therefore not to be trusted.
Today is an anniversary. 12 years ago, Larry Osborne was exonerated.
That's Senator Gerald Neal, a Louisville Democrat who has sponsored legislation to replace capital punishment with life without parole. In 1997, Osborne was accused of murdering two people, and in 1999, he was convicted and sentenced to death at 19 years old, making him the youngest in Kentucky's history to receive the sentence. But a retrial in 2002 heard new testimony in his case, ultimately leading to his exoneration that year. It's the kind of occurrence that worries Representative David Floyd, a Republican from Bardstown, who has sponsored legislation identical to Senator Neal's.
You cannot have a death penalty in place where the possibility of the execution of an innocent does not occur. And so we must accept a certain level of risk if we're to continue the death penalty in Kentucky. So what is that risk? You know, all of us value human life. We shouldn't support, however, a government program that can kill innocent people. It's a government program that's run by human beings, and mistakes can be made. And with the death penalty, innocent people can, and I believe have, been executed.
Neal and Floyd filed similar legislation during the 2014 General Assembly, which stagnated in the judiciary committees of their respective chambers. Senator Whitney Westerfield, a death penalty supporter, is a chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He says he isn't sure if there's support for their bills for the next General Assembly, and says he is more seriously considering legislation filed by his colleague and fellow death penalty supporter Senator Robin Webb, a Democrat, which would add more safeguards to the current system rather than abolish it altogether.
Honestly, I'm not sure what it would take, but I can't say no to it, because it's still something that I'm wrestling with. The alternative is to not have the system in place, and there are still most people aren't ready to let go of that and may not ever be ready to let go of that.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people aren't ready to let go?
Because they believe it's a just result. And they're entitled to that belief, as am I, my belief, and you yours. But that's the way it is, I guess.
For Louisville resident Ruth Lowe, her beliefs changed drastically. She says she wrestled with wishing vengeance against the man who murdered her brother in 1983. After years of harboring hatred, she ultimately found that her anger over the crime was hurting herself most of all.
It's like taking the role of God on yourself. And I believe that God's love, if you're open to it, can change you. You change your heart, change your mind. And God's love is not about vengeance.
For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
Gas exploration along the Marcellus Shale is touted by politicians to create jobs and create a better economy for several Appalachian states. An environmental watchdog nonprofit just released a report identifying companies who are using diesel fuel in their horizontal drilling fluids. Apparently, that's illegal, without a special permit. Glennis Board of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
The nonprofit Environmental Integrity Project advocates for enforcement of environmental laws. They recently published a report entitled Fracking Beyond the Law. It asserts that illegal injection of diesel fuel during hydraulic fracturing has continued somewhat blatantly over the last 4 years. The report also notes that recently drilling companies have been modifying self-reported disclosures to remove any indication of diesel fuel use. Mary Green is the senior managing attorney with Environmental Integrity Project. She explained during a recent press conference.
Without obtaining a Safe Drinking Water Act permit, injection of diesel is against the law. Specifically, we identified 33 companies that fracked 351 wells in 12 different states between 2010 and July 2014. We contacted EPA in the states, and not a single permit application has been filed, and not a single permit has been issued.
Green went on to point out that her organization discovered several companies that currently sell fracking fluids, which contain diesel fuels. So here's the backstory. In 2005, Congress passed what has become known as the Halliburton Loophole, an energy policy act that exempted the oil and gas industry from requirements listed in the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. With the passage of the Halliburton Loophole, one of the only chemicals the Environmental Protection Agency was allowed to continue to regulate in the gas industry was diesel fuel. Congress left diesel fuels to the EPA's authority because they contain high levels of benzene, ethylbenzene, toluene, and xylene, known as BTEX chemicals. These are chemicals that are highly mobile in groundwater and are known to cause significant health problems. Green went on to affirm the significance of the report's findings and the value of the law disallowing diesel injections by citing a recent report out of Pennsylvania.
A July 22nd Pittsburgh Post-Gazette report used Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection data to document that fracking has damaged public water supplies 209 times since 2007.
The Environmental Integrity Project's report, Fracking Beyond the Law, was based solely on data that had been extrapolated from frackfocus.org, an online industry chemical disclosure registry. Green explained, while different states have varying requirements, information about the chemicals used in hydraulically fractured oil and gas wells is currently self-reported by oil and gas well operators on this site. She criticized FrackFocus because it has no oversight or corroboration mechanisms. Green questioned the accuracy of the data because operators can edit, add, and remove disclosures from the site without leaving a record of or explanation for the change. In fact, her organization noticed over the course of their investigation many diesel fuel disclosures disappearing.
These operators either used diesel or they didn't. Those who changed their disclosures, either months or sometimes even years after initially reporting diesel use, need to explain themselves and account for the change.
West Virginia was included in 12 states where industry operators reported using diesel fuel in their fracking practices. Data indicates that 7 wells in Upshur County, a couple in Taylor, and 1 in Webster, as well as 22 across state lines in Greene County, Pennsylvania, reported using diesel. A couple of the operators are small West Virginia companies, Triana and Mountain V. Triana said a vendor mistakenly identified diesel fuel as a component in fracking formula and that the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection was properly advised of the mistake. The most frequent operator to list using the fuel in this region is Energy Corporation of America, headquartered in Colorado. Company officials say in August of 2012, they became aware of an incorrect material safety data sheet that was provided by a vendor, which resulted in inaccurate data being entered into FrackFocus. Both companies admit changing their disclosures on the frackfocus.org site, the online industry chemical disclosure registry. Meanwhile, Mountain V did not change their disclosure nor respond to requests for comment. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
We'll hear more about that website, frackfocus.org, in just a bit. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A website called FrackFocus has become a national clearinghouse for information about the chemicals used in fracking. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports, transparency about those chemicals remains elusive.
This is a story about a place where big drilling meets big data. A website called FrackFocus. The site is run by an industry-supported nonprofit called the Groundwater Protection Council, a group of state regulators who oversee water quality and oil and gas development. A few years back, the group wanted to help the industry, give the public answers to a burning question about the shale gas boom.
What the heck's going down these wells?
In 2011, with funding from industry groups, FrackFocus was born. Drillers could voluntarily upload lists of the chemicals used to frack wells to release natural gas. The following year, Pennsylvania began requiring operators to use the website as part of the state's new chemical disclosure law. It's one of 14 states that have delegated their public disclosure systems to FrackFocus. Now, a farmer in, say, Washington County could log onto frackfocus.org, search for a well near her cow pasture, and pull up a PDF document from the company with a list of what went downhole. But some big data geeks say that's a problem.
My name is Paul Woods, and I'm the big data wrangler at SkyTruth.
SkyTruth is a nonprofit that uses publicly available data and satellite images to monitor the impacts of the industry on the environment, all from a tiny office in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So when the SkyTruth team learned about Frac Focus, Woods says they were psyched.
We thought, hey, this would be great. All the data's there.
But it turns out it wasn't so easy to get. Here's the problem. Drillers post their lists of chemicals as individual PDF documents for each well they frack. To mine all that data, SkyTruth would have had to open one PDF at a time, and then copy and paste all the information about each ingredient into a spreadsheet. Woods colleague David Manthos says it was a daunting task.
We calculated it was about 6 years worth of labor, and just at minimum wage would have been something on the order of $90,000 just to manually do this whole thing.
So Woods designed a bot, a software program that could do all the work for them. Every night, the bot scraped the site for all the available PDFs and compiled the information into a searchable database. And with Frac Focus's permission, SkyTruth published that database in 2012. It turns out they weren't the only ones interested in this information.
We were overwhelmed by the response of people contacting us, asking questions about the data set, downloading it, and then the subsequent reports and publications that used that data set to say very interesting things.
The Smithsonian used it to make an interactive map of shale gas wells across the country. Even a consulting firm that does data analysis for the industry tapped into SkyTruth's database. But one night last June, the bot hit a roadblock.
The first thing we noticed, there was no new data coming in. There was a little error message that was coming out that said, hey, you're sending too many requests. You're being blocked for 24 hours. And then they block you for 48 hours, and then they block you forever.
The Groundwater Protection Council, the nonprofit that runs Frac Focus, had set up a system to block automated programs like SkyTruth's bot. The council says it was to prevent bots from slowing down traffic to the site. Remember the farmer with the cow pasture living near a gas well? The Groundwater Protection Council says that's who Frac Focus was meant for, not groups like SkyTruth looking for big data on drilling. The council wouldn't agree to a recorded interview, but we spoke with Associate Director Dan Yates, who explained that to get companies to voluntarily disclose what's in their fracking fluid, the council had to agree it would only serve up the data one well at a time. Yates admits that's up for reconsideration, in part because those 14 states have required drillers to use the website. Frac Focus has come under new scrutiny as the Obama administration considers whether to use it as a disclosure tool for fracking on public lands.
I think there are a number of interests being represented by Frac Focus, and I think those who manage the database are having to juggle a lot of those interests.
Kate Konchnick is director of the Environmental Policy Initiative at Harvard Law School. In a report last year, Konchnick gave Frac Focus a failing grade as a disclosure tool. She found that the data were often inaccurate and that companies were making trade secret claims for chemicals at one well site while fully disclosing the same chemicals at another.
Not maybe as robust a tool as one would hope if something is regulated or required by state law.
Konchnick says the pressure is on the Groundwater Protection Council. The council says it's open to change and is already working to fix some of the site's limitations. So what became of SkyTruth's efforts to get the data? It's been just over a year since the bot was blocked from the site. Paul Woods says,
We're stalled.
In the spring, SkyTruth teamed up with another environmental nonprofit called Frac Tracker, based in Pittsburgh, to try to work things out with the site's administrators. So far, no deal. Today, Frac Focus has records for more than 70,000 wells. Data miners are frustrated that the big information inside Frac Focus has been purposefully made so small. Samantha Malone from Frac Tracker puts it this way.
Imagine trying to understand your financial spending throughout the year by taking photos of all of your receipts of anything you ever purchased the entire year. You would need to look at each one at a time, and even then you still couldn't see the big picture.
Without big data, Woods from SkyTruth says, even individual homeowners can't see the big picture of how the shale boom is impacting them or their communities.
The kind of people who are going to answer those questions for you are people like us. And if we can't get the data because they only want to give it to individual homeowners about their individual wells, then they haven't really accomplished public disclosure.
Katie Colinari, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a public media reporting project of WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, focusing on the state's energy economy. To watch a video of this story, visit stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. Do you have consistent access to water? Is it safe? Treat it? Residents in several southern West Virginia communities do not. But a project is bringing some folks one step closer to safe public water. The Elkhorn Regional Water Project in McDowell County will replace two water systems that date back about 70 or 80 years. A yellow backhoe knocks rocks from a mountainside as another construction vehicle drills through rock along Route 52 in Elkhorn. Work began in late June to replace the Elkhorn and Mayberry water systems. The aging, leaky Elkhorn water tower that sits on the other side of the road will soon be out of commission.
Our goal is to provide as much clean water as we can for every citizen of McDowell County.
That's Eldon Green. He's the assistant director of the McDowell County Public Service District.
There's a crumbling, decaying, almost non-existent water system in the area, and not even all of our households have that public water. Some have springs and wells. But as with any rural community where the major industry has come and gone, we face negative things. We face low incomes. We face dilapidated housing. And it's just been a terrible, terrible struggle.
Green says several of the systems throughout the county were built, then left by coal companies.
And essentially we became a captive workforce to big coal. And I'm not trying to be anti-coal on that, but that's essentially what happened. And now, since the bloom is off the rose, so to speak, with the coal industry, and a lot of the coal has been gone, and it being a non-renewable resource, therefore we're faced with an exodus of a lot of our people, with a crumbling of the infrastructure that was here. It's almost non-existent today.
The Elkhorn Regional Water Project has been in the works for several years, and it was further delayed when the federal government halted abandoned mine land funding to review the applications earlier this year.
And we are very grateful for how that through the slow-moving bureaucratic process of the government, we're finally seeing this good thing happen in our county today.
Abandoned mine land money comes from a fund created by a tax on coal companies. The money is used to reclaim and fix damage left from previous mining activity. Congressman Nick Rahal says he met with officials earlier this year about the funding. Rahal attended the groundbreaking ceremony in Kimball.
These projects are really crucial for clean water for the people of southern West Virginia, and their clean water has been impacted by the previous mining of coal, which is so important to our state as well. So, we've been able to break some of these projects loose and get clean water and replace old systems in many cases so that our people can have what many in the big city just take for granted when they get up every morning, and that's clean, drinkable, accessible water. And that's what we're celebrating in Kimball today.
Phase 1 in Elkhorn is also funded by a grant and loan from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development. The project continues down Route 52 with two more phases. It's three of several plans in the works to bring clean water throughout the county. Green says 6 years ago, the McDowell PSD had about 500 customers. Now he's proud to say there's more than 3,000, and several other projects are in the works. The Big Sandy Rotorfield extension will bring clean water to his own home.
Personally, right now, I have a deep well and a pump, and the water's not the greatest, but we're thankful for it. But that's generally the case all through the Tug Valley in our county here, where most folks outside of municipality have well water. Few have springs. I have a water treatment system, personally, that is salt-based, and they say over the long term that's not good. But we're thankful for what we have.
Phase 1 of the Elkhorn Regional Water Project will bring clean water to 200 homes. Green says the PSD plans to pay back the loan within 30 years, meaning water bills could increase about $30 a month. Phase 1 is expected to be complete in spring of 2015. The Letcher County Farmers Market is the first in Kentucky to offer free meals cooked on-site from market vegetables to children 18 and under. The Farmers Market recently celebrated with its many partners, including the Letcher County School System, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Kentucky Department of Education, and, of course, the farmers who make it all possible in Whitesburg. Elizabeth Sanders with WMMT reports.
Those were the sounds of local musicians playing at the Letcher County Farmers Market in downtown Whitesburg. The blender you heard in the background is part of the food preparation for the summer feeding program, of which the Farmers Market site is the first of its kind.
Big news today, we had our highest reach, and there were 57 meals served today. So, for the summer feeding program, that is a big number.
That was Valerie Horn, Project Director of Apple Tree, Appalachians Together Restoring Our Eating Environment, speaking at a press conference at the Letcher County Farmers Market on Saturday, July 26. The press conference was called to celebrate the U.S. Department of Agriculture's designation of the Letcher County Farmers Market as a summer feeding site. Along with Mayor James Wiley Craft, Letcher County Judge Executive Jim Ward welcomed everyone.
It's not all about selling the products as much as it is bringing the community back together. And if you look at the faces in the crowd, that's what a lot of this is about.
The summer feeding program site at the Farmers Market provides free farm-to-table meals to children under the age of 18 throughout the summer break. Adults can buy breakfast at a discounted price. Cindy Wilmarth spoke on behalf of the Kentucky Department of Education.
Part of our job, what we get to do is we get to celebrate, and this is one of the biggest celebrations that we have had. I have a little note here from Mike. This site served 65 meals or 57 meals today. Last month, the total amount of meals was 65. So that's a huge growth. So congratulations to you. That's wonderful. And I also, I have heard, and I can say this with pretty good authority, that this is the only farmers market feeding site for summer in the country. So wow, yeah. And USDA is very, very excited about this model.
Local, state, and national partnerships were built and solidified in order to make this program possible. Some of the many partners include the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the National School Lunch Program, Kentucky Department of Education, Community Farm Alliance, the East Kentucky Food Systems Collaborative, Grow Appalachia hosted by Cowan Community Center, the Mountain Shrine Club, the Mountain Heritage Festival Committee, the Letcher County School System, the Letcher County Health Department, Whitesburg Mayor James Wiley Craft, and the Whitesburg City Council.
I say sometimes there are disadvantages to living in a small town. And it's very rarely that I say that, but sometimes there are. But sometimes there are some huge advantages to living in a small town, and this was one of the cases where that paid off. We knew what we needed and who could help us with that. So with just a matter of a few phone calls, we were able to get this program going. It's a little step, but we're in motion and have laid the foundation, and have hopefully some bigger plans that will be moving from this next year.
And the last thing we celebrate here is community. There's something that magical that happens when people come together in a community and do something like this. They say, we can make this happen. We can do this. This is a model for what's to come all over the country. And we couldn't think of anything better for right now than what's happening here.
Again, that was Cindy Wilmarth and Valerie Horn. The summer feeding program also increases business for local farmers, as well as increasing access of healthy foods to the community. Don Maggard spoke on behalf of the growers.
Does everybody like bean and corn? Yeah. Good. It's over on the table. Take it home with you. No, I'm glad to be a part of this year. It's helped me in many different ways, a lot of different ways. It's helped me, and I'm glad that all the friends and people that I've met since I've been here, and all that means a lot to me to be able to meet people and talk with them and learn about them, how they grow this and how they grow that. But without the other help that I have received through Grow Appalachia and all the other programs there that they have mentioned, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing, because I'm retired, just a retired coal miner, worked 37 years underground in the coal mines, and I'm glad today to be a part of this, and it has meant a lot to me, because I know how you all, any of you that just depends upon Social Security, then this year is a great big help when it comes to money-wise, and I'm glad today to be a part of that. And I thank you all for everything that you buy from me. It means a lot, and I thank you for it.
Again, that was Don Maggard. There were also representatives present from Congressman Hal Rogers and Governor Steve Beshear's offices. Both spoke to how this program aligns with the vision of the SOAR, Shaping Our Appalachian Region, initiative, a region-wide initiative led by the governor and congressman. Daniel Wilson, Wolf County Agriculture Extension Agent and chair of the SOAR Agriculture Community Regional Foods Working Group, delivered the following statement on behalf of the governor.
This project exemplifies the positive impact that a public-private partnership can have on a community. Thanks to the cooperative efforts of many government agencies and philanthropic groups, Letcher County now has a sustainable, healthy foods program that directly benefits resident children and farmers while emphasizing the importance of nutrition, agriculture, and buying local.
The market also accepts WIC benefits. WIC participants can pick up vouchers from the Letcher County Health Department, $20 worth per participant. Due to the market's partnership with Community Farm Alliance, they also participate in the Double Dollars program, where any WIC participant using vouchers can receive double the dollar amount in produce. Tim McNeely, Rural Development Coordinator for the Kentucky USDA office, also spoke.
You guys have done something that serves as a model that can be replicated throughout the country. We're very proud of you for that. It means a lot to know that in Whitesburg we've got a model that can serve the rest of the country, and it's an exciting time for you, and it's an exciting time for us.
While the farmers market summer feeding side has finished for the season, it will be back next summer. Children can still get hot meals during the week in the Letcher County Central High School cafeteria. The Letcher County Farmers Market runs 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. every Saturday through October and will soon accept SNAP benefits. Letcher County Agriculture Extension Agent Shad Baker helped close with the following words.
You know, there's been a thought of uncertainty about what lies ahead for our county. And we feel like when we see something like this, that people are learning to be entrepreneurs, they're learning how to produce something off the land, and they're making use of the resources that they have. The future of that community has to be great. And when our children see what we're doing, that has to be an encouragement to them, and it works out for the best for them in the future.
Reporting for WMMT, I'm Elizabeth Sanders.
Still to come, we'll hear how old-time music traditions stay alive in parts of Appalachia. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This next story brought back so many memories of singing at family reunions and church with my grandparents, and I'm not alone. It's a culture of music that's been passed down orally through the hills of Appalachia for many generations. Old-time music has roots in Celtic and Native American cultures, as well as American ballads and popular music and poems that have been passed down through oral tradition. After a visit to Sophia, West Virginia, I was happy to find that the practice of learning young the tunes of their ancestors is alive and well in Raleigh County. Shadow of Love. It's a song written and played by Carl Hensley of Beckley. He's one of a small group of bluegrass folk and gospel lovers hoping to keep youth in tune with the old-time music. I'm here. A group of folks gather in a horseshoe shape during a weekly old-time music jam session at the fire department in Sofia.
I think we need to try to do everything that we can to preserve it because it is a dying, it's going away.
Carl Hensley grew up in Ipman in Wyoming County. Hensley says he's written several country songs and even sold a few. You see, a good country song, Hensley says, tells a story like Shadow of Love.
There's a lot of good words in a good country song, you know. And most of it is something somebody has experienced. It may be a story about them. It may be a story about their neighbor. For an example, a song I wrote, Shadow of Love. One of my daughters was sitting at the table. My little daughter walked in. She said, well, there's my shadow of love. Well, I said, well, that'd make a good title. So I came up with Shadow of Love.
Hensley lives in Beckley now and has been coming to the jam session for more than 20 years.
We started this thing down here right about 89 or 90, somewhere along there. And it's different people's been in charge of it for a period of years, you know. And one dies off and the other one takes over, so.
Oh, death. Oh, death. Won't you spare me over till another year?
Well, and that's the idea, to keep playing with an open invitation, hoping that someone will always be there to take over. If not, Hensley says, Appalachians lose a part of their heritage.
We lose that. We've lost part of it. The younger generation is just not going to pick it up and continue. However, we have taught two or three young ones right in here, and they've turned out to be excellent.
One of those youngsters is Sofia resident Jordan Young.
Midnight on the stormy deep, my solitary watch I keep.
A college student at Glenville State, Jordan Young is passionate about bluegrass music. He plays mandolin, guitar, banjo, upright bass, and sings.
If somebody doesn't play it, it will die. I mean, it's just like in every other form of music, especially take country, for instance. All you hear nowadays is songs about trucks and partying and fields and things like that. And I'd hate to see that happen to something as pure as bluegrass music. And I'd like to see it kind of stay in its original form, you know, just the way it should be acoustic.
Grandfather Bob Fan tried to get him to play when Young was about 5 years old. He admits he wasn't into it, but in the year 2000, a movie ignited his passion.
I seen the movie Old Brother, Where Art Thou? And I heard the mandolin part on the song Man of Constant Sorrow do that little kickoff, you know. And I said, well, I want to do that. And then I realized, well, my papa plays that type of stuff. He can show me how to do it. And I remember it was on my 12th birthday. I just said, show me a few chords on the mandolin. He was sitting in the garage playing it. That's just how it was.
The place where he was buried.
I think I was trying to find a way for me to get closer to him because I stayed at his house all the time, and it's just something we could do together.
Young says it was his grandfather that took him to jam sessions. For Young, it was time spent with his family and a place to learn.
That's where I learned to play, honestly. I knew maybe four chords on a mandolin. He said, well, I'll take you someplace where you can kind of just play around with people. And through time, I got to taking solos with him, and it just helped me so much.
His grandfather passed away about a year ago, and now it's more important than ever for Young to carry on the tradition.
I'd like to make him proud, you know, and just keep it the way he kind of liked it, you know.
Young is now a student at Glenville State College, getting a degree in bluegrass. The website boasts it is the world's first four-year Bachelor of Arts degree in bluegrass music.
We emphasize strictly on traditional bluegrass music in order to preserve it. And that's a big thing to me, is to keep it not necessarily exactly the same how it used to be, but keeping it close to it, you know. And it makes me happy that people think that I'm doing something good for it, you know.
Young says studying bluegrass and old-time music offers a window into Appalachia's past.
Even the high-speed fiddle dance tunes, banjo songs, and things like that, it's a way to, for Appalachian people especially, in harder times back in the 30s and stuff, when things were really bad, just a way for them to get their mind off of things, you know, and just have a good time and sing songs about the way they're feeling.
And it's a way for Young to study the history of Appalachia, carry on stories from generations past, and a way to cherish the memory and legacy of his grandfather.
I'll meet you on God's golden shore. He'll meet you on God's golden shore.
Coming up, more music as we learn more about Uncle Dude. This is Inside Appalachia. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Although he's virtually unknown outside of Pocahontas County, West Virginia, Glenn Irvine was one of the area's most gifted musicians, one of the founding members of the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys. Glenn, or Uncle Dude, as he was known, was a virtuoso, self-taught musician. And as Roxy Todd reports, after contracting polio as a young boy, Dude spent most of his life in a wheelchair, but his mandolin almost never left his side.
Uncle Dude, that lived with us most of the time, the one really taught us all how to play music. He played in beer joints all the time, just about every Saturday night.
Richard Hefner says he used to wait up for his uncle to come home after those gigs. It was the only quiet night inside the family's Civil War era home, in the house that was almost always full of music whenever his uncle was home.
Somebody'd come and carry him out because he was crippled, and they'd carry him out and put him in the car, and then they'd carry him in the beer joint and set him in a chair. I'd usually stay up until Dude come home at night, listen to his tales.
These tales usually included whatever beer joint brawl or late night escapade had taken place that night at the square dance. In the house that may or may not have been haunted, Richard grew up idolizing his uncle, whose real name was Glenn Irvine, but everyone just called him Dude. When he was 14 years old, Richard began going with his uncle to the beer joints. There was one beer joint he took his uncle to often, called High Rocks. Richard remembers when a bad fight broke out at the High Rocks bar, right next to his Uncle Dude.
I guess I was 16 and had my license, and I took him up there, and he was playing with Virgil and Vincent Ryder. Dude played the mandolin, and it was a little small place. It was small as this room about, narrower. And a bunch of guys came from Richwood, and Richwood and Marlington at that time didn't like each other. And that guy just walked over and said something to him. Boy, he come off there and hit that guy. And I grabbed Dude and slid him back behind that stove, two of them went right through the front door, tore the whole door off the beer joint, out in the parking lot. And they was five or six of them just got really whipped up pretty bad in there that night. But they, it just like always, you know, just as soon as they got everything settled down, slid dude back out on the floor, got back in tune, started playing again, you know.
On the guitar, dude could fingerpick any Chet Atkins country tune. He taught himself to play harmonica when he was 5 years old, and he later taught himself to play mandolin, banjo, ukulele, and slide guitar. Night after night, musicians would come to the Hefner home to play with dude.
There was always somebody here at the house playing, and everybody in my mom's side of the family played and sang. An uncle dude, who he always had somebody in here playing, and they did all kinds of country and blues, and of course they did some bluegrass tunes too. So they got to doing them, you know, just kind of along, mixing them in with country and honky-tonk and Elvis and Chet Atkins tunes and everything else.
Richard and his siblings remember that Dude didn't let his physical limitations drag him down. He was born with a condition called hydrocephalus, which causes fluid to swell near the brain. For some, this impairs mental intelligence. But in Dude's case, he was probably above normal intelligence. He taught himself to read and write, and even helped his own siblings with their homework. Because he suffered from polio as a little boy and couldn't walk, Dude spent part of his childhood being pulled in a wagon until one of the neighbors bought him a wheelchair. He never had a job, except for the cashier and playing at local square dances and beer joints.
But I remember one time Dude, he played for $5 a piece a night, and he'd come home and he said, "Gilbert, give us a raise, he's paying us $6 now." He was tickled to death, you know, he got a dollar a raise.
Eventually, Richard and his brother Bill learned to play from their uncle. Soon, they all began to play more and more of Bill Monroe's bluegrass tunes. This was in the late 1950s and into the 1960s, around the time when they formed the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys.
There wasn't much bluegrass around here. There wasn't any bluegrass around here until we started playing.
Soon, the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys began writing their own songs. And in 1971, they recorded their first album, Pure Old Bluegrass. It was the only one of the band's albums that Uncle Dude played on. In January of 73, he passed away at the age of 52.
If I could come back to that old country church and once more hear the...
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd.
We've traveled together through dark and sunny days, and may we always be together, just my Lord and I along the way. The service now ending, and the parson pours his grave in solemn, quiet benediction upon our different way. We've traveled on together through dark and sunny days, and may we always be together, just my Lord and I along the way.
This is Inside Appalachia.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, WUOT in Knoxville, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. Other music heard on today's show was by Andy Agnew Jr. of Barlington, West Virginia, from his album, Originals by a West Virginian. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can check us out on Twitter, too, at WV Public News or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.